Blog Talk Radio.
And greetings once again. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and we'll be right back with this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And we just heard the sound of Hugh Mandel, and that was a medley of tunes related to the plight of African people worldwide, Stop Them Jah. Black Man Foundation, and prior to that, we heard the sound of Shala Mualla, who was, of course, presented in a medley of tunes as well. And this is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal for this week. Today, June 15th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. Last weekend, we brought you a remote broadcast from New York City at Pace University, where we were participating in the Left Forum. We were, of course, covering the War on Africa panel that took place at Pace University during the Left Forum just this last past weekend. And, of course, we were involved in the Left Forum speaking on four different panels throughout the course of the conference, and participated in other discussions and other panels, as well as being involved in discussions outside the rooms and lecture halls at the Left Forum, discussing various tactical and strategic issues with other activists from around the United States and indeed from around the world. And of course, we are here to provide you with this type of alternative information. Just this last past week, we were in a position to, and of course did, present a remote broadcast from Pace University in New York City. And the other aspects of the Left Forum included a tremendous amount of literature that was available at the various exhibits that were in evidence, being able to meet other activists from around the United States and from around the world. and also to engage in observation about whether what other organizations and tendencies are doing and saying in regard to the situation that is taking place around the world. So, yes, it was definitely a worthwhile experience at, of course, the Left Forum just this last past week. It was held between June 7th and 9th in Lower Manhattan, New York City, at Pace University. At the Left Forum, there were over 350 panels and well over 1,000 participants at the gathering. It's the largest scholarly gathering of left-wing thinkers and activists in the United States. That's held annually. And we are honored, of course, to be a part of the Left Forum. And we're going to take another brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And, of course, we are here today, June 15, 2013, broadcasting live from studios here in the city of Detroit. And we, of course, are happy to be back with you again in regard to the situation all over the world, from Detroit to Istanbul, Turkey, to the Durban, South Africa, all the way to Caracas, Venezuela, and back. You can find all of the most updated, pressing and burning issues related to the situation throughout the entire length and breadth of the world. And we just heard the sound of Desmond Dekker in that last composition entitled Shanty Town from, I believe, the first album that gained international notoriety by Desmond Dekker. Of course, Desmond Dekker having one of the, perhaps the first reggae or perhaps ska hits on the U.S. charts, song entitled The Israelites from 1969. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe, and we'd like to play another composition from Desmond Dekker, and we'll be right back with this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire.
Never see you when you jump over the wall. You think I never see you when you accidentally fall. Make your puppy up in the door. Why you accidentally fall? Did you crying out the ice
Double O7.
You just heard a medley of tunes by the legendary Desmond Dekker, that last one entitled Unity, U-N-I-T-Y. We also heard Rude Boy Train by Desmond Dekker. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And right now, we're going to move into this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we're going to be covering the following stories. The Southern African nation of Zimbabwe has set national elections for July 31st. Sources inside and outside the subcontinent say that the ruling ZANU-PF party is slated to win the upcoming poll. The economic crisis hitting Detroit has taken on an added significance with a proposal issued yesterday, June 14th, at Wayne County Airport. Kevin Orr, the emergency manager appointed by Governor Rick Snyder, has declared a moratorium on debt payments to the banks and creditors. Payment of over $30 million was not made on June 14th. There have been new revelations related to leaks from the National Security Agency, a development that has generated tremendous controversy for the last week. Edward Snowden, a NSA contract employee, has been targeted for vilification and prosecution by the U.S. government. And finally, the African states of Egypt and Ethiopia are in a diplomatic row over the plans by Addis Ababa to reroute sections of the Blue Nile River. The two states have been urged by the African Union to work towards resolution of the dispute. And right now, we're going to move into our Pan-African Newswire reports. And according to today's Zimbabwe Herald, the Western countries are being urged not to be interfering in the upcoming elections that will be taking place on July 31st in Zimbabwe. According to Zimbabwe Vice President Joyce Mujuru, she said that Zimbabweans should be wary of Western countries bent on causing political disturbances in an attempt to discredit the electoral processes in the country. Now, Vice President Mujuru said this as the country geared up for harmonized elections on July 31st. Western interference in the country's electoral process would not be tolerated. She made the remarks at Honduras on June the 14th while addressing hundreds of apostolic faith church members during the church's 100-year anniversary. She said that, quote, "We are a sovereign state and we are able to develop our country alone. We do not need guidance from Western countries, as most of them have shown us that they are there to siphon our resources only," unquote, the vice president said. She went on to point out that in a bid to achieve their targets, some of them come to cause divisions among ourselves, and while we will be fighting, they will be busy looting our resources, and this is a thing we should be wary of, unquote. Now, Vice President Mujuru took a swipe at leaders of some political parties in the inclusive government who are not able to solve their problems internally and seek the intervention of other countries. She said that, quote, "Some of us, instead of sitting down for negotiations, when there are disagreements, they go around the world seeking the intervention of other countries," unquote. Now, this is a sign of immaturity because those countries do not have a say in our affairs, and they will never influence our operations. Zimbabweans' problems should be solved by Zimbabwean people, unquote. Government, according to the vice president, will continue working with churches because of the two were inseparable since the liberation struggle. Vice President Mujuru said that, quote, "ZANU-PF is about the people, and churches are also about people," meaning we will continue working hand in hand to improve the conditions and the welfare of our people, unquote. She also went on to say the same applies with traditional leaders. Some people say ZANU-PF has patronized traditional leaders, but how can you separate the Revolutionary Party with the custodians of the land, the chiefs? Our people need land, and ZANU-PF has been fighting for that since time immemorial. And now, to ensure everyone benefits, it has to work with traditional leaders, unquote. Now, the vice president urged Zimbabweans to coexist and tolerate each other ahead of the elections. She said that the ZANU-PF party had resolved to expel party leaders and members who fan violence in the name of the Revolutionary Party. The vice president said, quote, "We have crafted our constitution as a party, and one of the guidelines is that those who cause violence, be it leadership or ordinary members, in the name of ZANU-PF or President Mugabe, should be fired forever," unquote. The vice president also said that violence hinders development and it should never be given any chance. She said that despite different political affiliations, at the end of the day, we will discover that we are all Zimbabweans. She said that people should choose leaders of their choice, and we also do not tolerate the imposition of candidates, unquote. Churches, the vice president said, should also participate in the indigenization and empowerment program being implemented by the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party. She said, quote, "Some of you took the land reform program for granted and were left out in the exercise, but now we are moving towards economic empowerment, and this is an opportunity you should make use of to empower yourself," unquote. The Apostolic Christian Church of Zimbabwe's Bishop Yohannes Ndanga urged church members to register as voters and vote resoundingly for President Mugabe in the polls. He said the sanctions imposed on the country by Western countries had brought untold suffering among Zimbabweans. Bishop Ndanga said, and we quote, "This is the time to defeat the MDC and its allies once and for all. We have been made to appear as beggars simply because of sanctions, but we remain vigilant and succeeded in the face of the embargo," unquote. He went on to say that we are always open, that we support ZANU-PF because of its clear empowerment program, and we pledge to continue working with the Revolutionary Party forever, unquote. Now, these celebrations were attended by senior government officials as well as traditional leaders. And in the city of Detroit, the city will immediately stop payments on about $2 billion in debt. The city's emergency manager announced this on Friday, June the 14th, in an effort to conserve cash. The manager, Kevin Orr, also said Detroit will need to cut pay and pension and health benefits for city workers. Debt holders are likely to get only pennies on the dollar. Orr said that, quote, financial mismanagement, a shrinking population, a dwindling tax base, and other factors over the past 45 years have brought Detroit to the brink of financial and operational ruin, unquote. Now, Orr met with the city's leading creditors behind closed doors yesterday, June the 14th, during the morning hours, presenting his preliminary restructuring plan. He said further meetings are planned with the unions representing the city employees. Orr's statement, a 134-page restructuring plan, did not mention the word, quote, bankruptcy, unquote, but the risk still looms. Orr is on record saying he wants to avoid bankruptcy, but cannot rule it out. It would be the largest city in U.S. history to file for bankruptcy protection. Now, attorney Michael Sweet, an expert in municipal bankruptcy, said he thinks bankruptcy will be the ultimate outcome. He said that, quote, Orr's meeting with creditors ensures that he makes a good faith effort to negotiate debts, unquote. That's according to Sweet. He went on to say that, quote, while bankruptcy still comes with certain stigmas, it would allow Detroit the opportunity to reinvent itself, unquote. Now, Orr's plan calls for reducing $11.5 billion in unsecured debt, including pensions, health care funds, and loans not backed by assets, down to $2 billion. That would be about 83% reduction in what investors and retirees owed. The restructuring plan received support from Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, who appointed him to the post just this last past month. And as we mentioned before, Detroit is suspending payments on $2 billion of unsecured debt. They are going to be marketing parking garages and telling retirees to rely on President Barack Obama's health care law to avoid a record municipal bankruptcy. Now, those are among proposed changes in a 128-page restructuring plan emergency manager Kevin Orr offered yesterday at a meeting of creditors in Detroit. The moves, including spending of $1.25 billion over the 10 years to bolster safety and remove blight, will give an insolvent city a viable future. And Orr went on to say that we have to strike a balance between the legacy of obligations to our creditors and our employees and retirees and the duty as a city to 700,000 residents for lights, police, fire, emergency management, cleaning the streets, etc., Orr told reporters after the meeting. And we've been following developments surrounding the economic crisis in Detroit for some time now. Just this last past Monday, Orr gave his first public address to present his plan before the people of the city of Detroit. It was held at the Wayne State University Law School on June the 10th. Hundreds of people showed up at the gathering, most of whom were not able to get in. The Moratorium Now Coalition held a picket line outside calling for the halting of debt service payments to the banks, saying that the banks created the crisis in the city of Detroit and around the country and indeed the world, and it is they who must pay for it. The demonstration on Monday, of course, was covered widely by the local as well as national press. A series of articles have been published just this last past week in numerous news agencies throughout the United States and throughout the world in relationship to the crisis here in the city of Detroit. And, of course, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And just this last past week, of course, there were revelations that circulated in regard to the massive spying operation that is being carried out by the United States through the national security agencies. And, of course, Edward Snowden, a 29-year-old contract employee for a company that does work for the National Security Agency, has reportedly leaked information that the National Security Agency and the White House do not want revealed to the international community. A series of articles have been published in The Guardian magazine, as well as other publications throughout the United States, Europe, and indeed the world. The U.S. At this point is making an effort to do damage control, and of course it is almost impossible since this issue has been taken up by many forces throughout the length and breadth of the world. And an article just this last past week in the Christian Science Monitor, and of course the article was written by David Grant. It was published on Thursday, June the 13th. It says that Americans will soon be able to judge for themselves the merits of the National Security Agency programs to vacuum up massive amounts of digital data because intelligence officials hope to declassify terrorist attacks thwarted by the controversial data mining systems as early as Monday. The Senate's top lawmaker on intelligence issues, this is what was said just this last past Thursday, June the 13th. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, told reporters that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, is working to declassify some examples of terrorist plots in the U.S. and abroad that were thwarted by sweeping NSA phone calls and social media data collection systems. Mr. Clapper has previously said such surveillance efforts help, quote, block dozens, unquote, potential attacks. And these are some of the damage control tactics that are being used by the United States government surrounding the situation. And, of course, Snowden could very well be prosecuted by the United States government. He's currently in Hong Kong. And according to The Guardian, in an article that was published just this last past Wednesday, June the 12th, entitled NSA Whistleblower Says He Is Not in Hong Kong to Hide from Justice and Alleges that the U.S. has hacked hundreds of targets in the People's Republic of China. The article says that the National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden vowed on Wednesday to fight any move by the United States to have him extradited from Hong Kong, saying he was not there to, quote, hide from justice, unquote, and will put his trust in its legal system. In his first comments since revealing in The Guardian at the weekend, Snowden also claimed that the U.S. had been hacking Hong Kong and said China, since 2009, had accused the U.S. of bullying the territory to return him because it did not want local authorities to learn of its cyber activities. Now, as a debate raged over whether Snowden should be praised or prosecuted for his actions, he told the South China Morning Post that, quote, I'm neither traitor nor hero. I'm an American, unquote. Now, Snowden claimed that the U.S. had hacked hundreds of targets in Hong Kong, including public officials, university businesses, and students in the city and on the mainland. These were part of more than 61,000 NSA hacking operations globally, he alleged. He said that, quote, we hack network backbones, like huge internet routers, basically, that gives us access to the communications of hundreds of thousands of computers without having to hack every single one, unquote. Now, the Post said it had seen a document that, quote, that Snowden alleged supported his claims. The Post said it had not verified the document and did not immediately publish it. Now, Snowden said he was releasing the information to demonstrate, quote, the hypocrisy of the United States government when it claims that it does not target civilian infrastructure, unlike its adversaries, unquote. A senior Chinese official said last week he had, quote, mountains of data, unquote, on cyber attacks from the U.S. after Washington turned up the pressure over hacking supposedly by China. Now, Jen Psaki, a spokeswoman for the State Department in Washington, said it was not aware of the hacking claims and could not comment directly, but she rejected the idea that such an incident would represent double standards given recent U.S. criticisms of China's cyber attacks. Quote, there's a difference between going after economic data and the issues of surveillance that the president has addressed, which are about trying to stop people doing harm, unquote. Now, Snowden, who is 29 years old, was a computer technical assistant working for Booz Allen Hamilton on contract to the National Security Agency. He left his job and home in Hawaii in May, set up camp in Hong Kong, and provided the Guardian newspaper based in London, England, with top-secret documents that led to a series of revelations about the extent of U.S. surveillance last week. Now, for 3 weeks, he stayed in a hotel in Kulong District, but after identifying himself as a whistleblower in a video posted by The Guardian just this last past Sunday, he felt that he needed to move to a more secure location and checked out on Monday, June the 10th. Hong Kong appeared a strange choice for Snowden, this is according to The Guardian, as it has a surrender treaty with the United States and leans towards cooperating with U.S. requests. But in his hour-long interview, Snowden told the South China Morning Post that, quote, people who think I made a mistake in picking Hong Kong as a location misunderstand my intentions. I'm not here to hide from justice. I'm here to reveal criminality, unquote. Snowden went on to say that, quote, my intention is to ask the courts and people of Hong Kong to decide my fate. I have been given no reason to doubt your system. Although China has had sovereignty over Hong Kong since 1997, the territory retains a separate legal system and trade and a tradition of free speech. Now, Beijing normally does not become involved in surrender hearings, technically not extradition, as Hong Kong is not a sovereign state, but could make an exception given the high-profile nature of this case. Now, even some human rights groups have questioned why he chose Hong Kong, given his control by China, but Snowden added, quote, I've had many opportunities to flee Hong Kong, but I would rather stay and fight the United States government in the courts because I have faith in Hong Kong's rule of law, unquote. Now, the Hong Kong government has made no comment yet about the case. The chief executive of the Hong Kong government, Leung Chun Ying, on a visit to New York, repeatedly refused to comment on the case in a Bloomberg television interview. Now, Snowden may have opted to give the interview to the Post to help build up a case for his being allowed to remain in Hong Kong, where opinion is divided between those expressing support and those who would like him to leave. Now, he is turning into a cause celeb with a demonstration in support of him that is planned today, June the 15th. Now, it would be difficult for the Hong Kong police to arrest him until such time as the U.S. makes a request for his return, since he has committed no crime in the city. In theory, he could attempt to fly out of the city, but it's likely he would be prevented from boarding the plane. Now, similarly, if he were to attempt to move to mainland China, it is likely he would be stopped at the border. In any case, Snowden told the South China Post that he planned to stay in Hong Kong until he was asked to leave. In Washington, outspoken Republican Congressman Peter King called for the arrest of the Guardian columnist who led the reporting on the NSA leaks, Glenn Greenwald. King told Fox News that Greenwald's stories were, quote, putting American lives at risk and clearly done to hurt Americans, unquote. In a statement, the Guardian said it was, quote, surprised and disappointed, unquote, by these comments. In a separate development, the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, rejected suggestions that U.S. surveillance programs were being used by U.K. authorities to avoid local privacy laws and spy on British citizens. On a visit to Washington, where he met with the Secretary of State, John Kerry, he said that, quote, no two countries in the world work more closely to protect the privacy of their citizens than the United Kingdom and the United States, unquote. Kerry said they both understood the, quote, very delicate but vital balance between privacy and the protection of people in our country, unquote. And this story has been covered extensively over the Pan-African Newswire, and we're going to tell you in just a few minutes how you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of these very pressing and burning issues. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. Today, June 15th, 2012, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And, of course, the African states of Egypt and Ethiopia have been involved in a diplomatic row over the last several days. Addis Ababa has been developing a program for the rerouting of sections of the Blue Nile River in order to construct a dam project for hydroelectric power. Now, according to Finian Cunningham, who is a East Africa correspondent and writes frequently for the Center for Research on Globalization based in Montreal, where many of the articles of Abayomi Ezekwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, are published on a weekly basis as well. Cunningham in the June 14th edition of the Press TV columns said that Ethiopia's parliament this week voted to push ahead with the country's controversial Blue Nile hydroelectric dam project. The move to raise the political stakes even higher following threats earlier this week by Egypt that it would go to war over Ethiopia's plans to build a $4.7 billion dam on the Great River. Now, Egypt claims that construction of the dam in Ethiopia will cause grave detriment to its supply of fresh water and spell ruin to its economy. Now, most of Egypt's 85 million people live on the banks of the Nile, and the country relies on the river for over 95% of its fresh water supply. Now, for millennia, Egyptian civilization has depended on the bountiful Nile, the world's longest river, stretching more than 6,500 kilometers from its source in Central Africa to its outlet in the Mediterranean Sea, just north of Egypt's capital of Cairo. The Nile comprises two tributaries. The longer White Nile originates in Burundi or Rwanda, still a matter of dispute among geographers, and it meets with the Blue Nile coming out of Ethiopia. The meeting point is near Khartoum, the river of North Sudan, and thence the Nile flows on to Egypt. However, it is the Blue Nile that provides more than 85% of the downstream water to the Loyal Nile. That is why the construction of the mega dam in Ethiopia has apparently provoked so much alarm in Egypt. Now, Ethiopia's Blue Nile hydroelectric project, the biggest in Africa, has been on the drawing board for several years, initiated by the country's late Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, who died last year. At the end of last month, Ethiopia began diverting the water of the Blue Nile to enable construction of the dam. Egypt has responded now with dire calls of national emergency led by its president, Mohamed Morsi. This week, Morsi said that his country reserved the right to militarily defend its vital national interests. Quote, all options are on the table. That's according to President Morsi of Egypt, adding that any drop of water loss will be replaced by Egyptian blood. Morsi has since toned down the war rhetoric towards Egypt, towards Ethiopia, by Egypt. But nevertheless, the relations between Africa's second and third most populous countries remain extremely fraught, especially in light of the latest move by Ethiopia's lawmakers to push ahead with the dam. Now, some Salafist members of Egypt's parliament have even called for covert sabotage of the dam, which at this stage is about 20% complete. Those calls prompted the Ethiopians this week to summon the Egyptian ambassador in Addis Ababa to explain his country's declared baneful intentions. Now, Ethiopia's concerns will have only been underscored by talking points released also this week by the Pentagon-aligned think tank Stratfor, which weighed on Egypt's options of military sabotage, including airstrikes and the demolition by special forces. So what is going on here, according to Finney and Cunningham? Nobody is denying that the Nile is a vital national interest for Egypt. But Cunningham goes on to say that, but it seems a reckless and outrageous leap of hysteria by Egypt to launch threats of war against Ethiopia over this issue. Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Haile Mariam Desalegn, has vowed that the Blue Nile hydroelectric scheme is not intended to adversely affect the flow of water to Egypt or Sudan. His view is supported by a recent study conducted by technical people from Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia, which concluded that there would be no significant long-term reduction in downstream water supply as a result of the dam. However, without presenting contrary evidence and expert evidence, Egypt's Morsi asserts that his country's water supply will be curtailed by 20%, a reduction that would indeed be catastrophic for the already drought-prone North African country. But this is the big question, Cunningham continues. Is Egypt's supply of fresh water really threatened? The scientific studies so far would say not. That raises the further question. Why is President Morsi making such a big deal about Ethiopia's Blue Nile project? The answer may be less to do with Ethiopia's diverting water and more to do with Morsi's diverting political problems with within his own country. Now, later this month, on June the 30th, there's a mass opposition rally planned in Cairo to mark the first anniversary of Morsi taking office. the Muslim Brotherhood president has seen a very rocky first year in power, with many Ethiopians, with many Egyptians not happy with his policies. And, of course, now with Ethiopians, of course, both in Ethiopia itself as well as inside of Egypt, are also upset with his policies. And it is President Morsi who took over in the executive capacity after the overthrow of former President Hosni Mubarak. Now, top of the popular grievances against Morsi in Egypt is his support for Salafist extremists in NATO's covert regime change war in Syria. Now, his continuing collusion with the State of Israel in its oppression of the Palestinians. And domestically, Morsi has been accused of doing little to improve the living standards of Egyptians, majority of impoverished workers and families. Now, Morsi's belligerent rhetoric over Ethiopia's Blue Nile project has sought to divert internal opposition to his government into an international dispute with a neighboring African country. Now, in his fiery speeches recently, Morsi has been working the crowds with jingoism and nationalism, stressing that Egyptians are, quote, at one, unquote, over their claims rights to the Nile water. The obvious theme by Morsi is to convince Egyptians to put aside their objections to its dubious governance and to focus instead on an ostensible external enemy, Ethiopia. Let's look at the issue from Ethiopia's point of view. The Blue Nile is geographically and a national resource of Ethiopia. It originates from the country's northern highlands, which drain into Lake Tana, one of Africa's largest lakes. From there, the Blue Nile meanders northwards on its long journey to the Mediterranean. The river might be accurately called the Brown Nile because of its muddy color, owing to the fertile minerals and organic matter that it leaches from the Ethiopian lands. Now, this is partly why the Nile has sustained Egypt's agriculture for a millennia, for many millennia. It is a river of natural goodness, courtesy of Ethiopia's rich soil. But the way Ethiopians see it, and they have just cause, is why should the country not be the first beneficiary of the powerful and fertile water of the Nile? After all, ask Ethiopians, does Egypt give away its natural gas and gas wealth to other countries for free? No. So why should Ethiopia permit its primary water resource to be freely accessed by others at the cost of its own pressing development needs? Egypt claims that it has historic and legal right to the Nile. This refers to a treaty signed in 1929 between the 11 countries that share the Nile water. They include the downstream countries of Egypt and Sudan, north and south, and the upstream lands of Ethiopia, Eritrea, Kenya, Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. That historic treaty gave Egypt and Sudan veto power over any of the upstream countries tapping water from the Blue Nile and White Niles. The treaty also gave Egypt the lion's share of the headwaters, some 70%. Who instigated that 1929 treaty? Well, wouldn't you know it, it was the jolly good old British Empire, who were in fact in firm control in North Africa during the late 1920s. Now, it was the British who insisted that their former colonial territories of Egypt and Sudan should receive the abundance of the Nile from the sub-Saharan African countries for free and forevermore. The legal rights that modern-day Egypt refers to are therefore the legacy of British colonialism that has designed, that was designed, and of course has been designed and still is designed to take advantage of the poor black African nations for the benefit of British capital in Egypt and Sudan. In other words, from a modern-day demographic and ethical point of view, the Nile Treaty that Egypt lionizes is not worth the British blood-spattered colonial-era paper it is written on. Now, seen from this vantage point, the Blue Nile is a vast natural resource that Ethiopia has not been allowed to avail of simply because of the historic British-imposed laws. While Egypt has for decades gained free water, soil fertility, and has constructed its own hydroelectric dams on the river, Ethiopia and the other African source countries are barred from such benefits. And yet the needs of Ethiopia's population are hardly dire. The country of 85 million, on parity with Egypt, is one of the poorest in the world, with some 70% of the population subsisting on less than $2 a day. A major factor in Ethiopia's underdevelopment is the lack of electricity. Every day, the country is subject to blackouts, a crippling impediment to humanitarian development. If the Blue Nile project goes ahead, it is projected to supply 6,000 megawatts of electricity, six times the output, for example, from Iran's Bushehr power station working at full capacity. But here's perhaps the winning argument. It is not just Ethiopia's sovereign rights to use this Blue Nile resource for the betterment of its people. And it's not just the rejection of arbitrary, unjust colonial-era laws. There's an all-important long-term ecological reason for why Ethiopia should go ahead with its hydroelectric plans. Ironically, this reason is also in Egypt's long-term interest. Now, mineralogical data is backed up by anecdotal observations of the Ethiopian elders that the country's rainfall has been seriously declining over many years. The vital rainy season is becoming shorter and more erratic. This ominous climate change is directly connected with the fact that Ethiopia has lost some 90% of its forest over recent decades. This lack of tree cover has resulted in the land becoming more arid and barren, posing a dangerous threat to not only food security in a famine-risk country, but also to the replenishment of Lake Tana and the Blue Nile. A primary reason for the deforestation in Ethiopia is the need for charcoal upon most Ethiopians relying for cooking and daily sustenance. That need for charcoal and resultant destruction of forests and decline in rainfall arises because of the chronic lack of electricity. If Ethiopia is to reverse its deforestation and dwindling rainfall, that will require giving its people access to electricity in order to obviate the unsustainable use of charcoal at the primary domestic fuel level. Now, the Blue Nile's hydroelectric project gives Ethiopia a way out of this dilemma by allowing the country to develop electrical power and to repair its ecological and water management. The future of the Blue Nile will also be conserved. The present prevailing situation of deforestation and declining water supply to the Blue Nile is in nobody's interest, including that of Egypt. Instead of declaring war and threatening to send its commandos to blow up Ethiopia's Nasset Dam project, Egypt's President Morsi should step back and view the big picture, not just for the sake of Ethiopians, but also for the sake of his country's long-term dependence on continued viability of the Blue Nile. Then Morsi might realize that all his reckless, bellicose rhetoric towards Ethiopia is, quote, damn stupid, unquote. And that was a commentary written by Finian Cunningham, who is the East Africa correspondent for the Center for Research on Globalization that is based in Montreal, Canada. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to review the top stories in the Pan-African Journal for this week. The Southern African nation of Zimbabwe has set national elections for July 31st. Sources inside and outside the subcontinent say that the ZANU-PF party is slated to win the upcoming poll. The economic crisis, which has hit Detroit, has taken on added significance with a proposal issued on June the 14th at Wayne County Airport. Emergency manager Kevin Orr declared a moratorium on debt payments to the banks that will amount to approximately $2.5 billion. A payment of over $30 million was not met on yesterday, June the 14th. There have been new revelations related to leaks from the National Security Agency, a development that has generated tremendous controversy over the last week. Edward Snowden, a NSA contract employee, has been targeted for vilification and prosecution by the United States government. And finally, the African states of Egypt and Ethiopia are in a diplomatic row over plans by Addis Ababa to reroute sections of the Blue Nile River. The two states have been urged by the African Union to work towards the resolution of the dispute. And with that, we're going to conclude this Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, blogs, and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And we'd also like to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And we want to encourage all of our listeners to, of course, log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. And on the Pan-African Radio Network, you can, of course, listen to this program again. You can also share this program via email, via blog, via website, also through social networking mechanisms such as Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and Tumblr. And we want to get this information out as broadly as possible for any broadcaster that is listening, whether they be over FM radio, AM radio, satellite radio, or internet radio. We want to encourage all of our listeners in the broadcast community, urge them and remind them that these broadcasts are free to circulate in part or in full. We want to get this information out, as we said before, as broadly as possible. So all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network over Blog Talk Radio, and you can have access to all of these broadcasts and you can check out our archives as well as see times for upcoming programs over the Pan-African Newswire as well as the Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And we're going to take another brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Hey, Don't worry. He's happy. In the wake of the revelations of intelligence contractor Edward Snowden that the U.S. government reaped billions of Americans' records and noted tens of millions of American cell phone records, apologists for the Patriot Act's draconian snooping programs rushed to defend this governmental intrusion by citing court and congressional approval and oversight. It sounds good, but what does it really mean? The court isn't really a court in a traditional sense. It's not in any courtroom open to the public. It's a secret court with secret judges who sit inside a soundproof room in the U.S. Justice Department. In the book The Shadow Factory by James Bamford, we find judges on this secret tribunal referring to the FISA court, FISA for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, as a Potemkin court, or a fake court that looks like a court but is really something else. As for Congress, it may do some things well, but oversight ain't one of them. L. Fletcher Prouty, an Air Force officer who worked with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on various CIA missions, tells of meeting with a senator to brief him on undercover operations. According to Prouty, the senator told him before the briefing began, "Keep it short. What I don't know about it won't hurt me." In other words, don't tell me. The government says, "It's okay. Don't worry. Be happy." From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that was the voice of the voiceless, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and talking about the NSA, National Security Agency, revelations, and also mentioning the work of journalist James Bamford, who has written a series of books revealing the secrets and secret policies and operations of the National Security Agency, one of the most secretive of the intelligence agencies inside the United States, which operates internationally. And Mumia Abu-Jamal was the subject of numerous panels and panel discussions just this last past weekend at the Left Forum, which yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, attended and broadcast the Pan-African Journal from the Left Forum live last week. And, of course, hope everyone enjoyed that program. And we're going to take a brief musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Somebody's watching you.
Somebody's watching you. Yes, two different versions of that same song, in essence, put together by the same people. The first one from Sly and the Family Stone from their 1969 classic album entitled Stand. And, of course, the second version came from Little Sister, which was a production of Stone Flower Productions put together by Sly, as well as his family, Stone, and that was entitled Somebody's Watching You. That song was released in 1970. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And just this last past week, there was an escalation in efforts on the role of the United States in the current situation inside the Middle Eastern nation of Syria. There were allegations made by the President of the United States saying, of course, that Syria had been involved in the usage of chemical weapons, although the United Nations has said that they have no direct proof that this is, in fact, the case. Of course, if one looks at this within a broader context in which the United States backed rebel forces have been losing tremendously on the battlefield in Syria. And, of course, the rebels have been in large part defeated in various parts of the country. This, of course, could provide a rationale for the situation involving the false claim that the Syrian government has utilized chemical weapons on the battlefield. Yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, was contacted by RT, Worldwide Satellite Television, just this last past week to do an interview over their network's world news program to discuss the current situation that is going on in Syria. Also, it was expressed that the U.S. Would be taking a calculated risk if it was to impose a no-fly zone over Syria. They have announced just this last past week that they're going to supply arms directly to the so-called rebel organizations inside of Syria. But the fact of the matter is they have always circuitously and even directly supplied arms, political support, and diplomatic cover to the counter-revolutionary rebels inside the Middle Eastern nation of Syria. So we're going to go right now to hear this RT segment that was broadcast just this last past week, featuring Abayomi Ezekwe of the Pan-African Newswire.
American and European intelligence agencies have reportedly concluded that the Syrian government has used chemical weapons on the rebels multiple times over the last year. President Obama is on record saying that the use of poison gas is a red line that would potentially trigger an intervention in the conflict. Well, for more on this, we are joined live by Abayomi Ezekwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. Thank you very much for coming onto the program this evening. Do you think these claims are trustworthy?
I think we need to see the evidence. This is a so-called red line that President Obama had drawn several months ago. He claims that if there's evidence of the movement of chemical weapons or the usage of chemical weapons, then, of course, this would require the United States to escalate its military intervention into Syria. Based upon the developments that have been taking place in Syria over the last 2 weeks in regard to the removal of rebels from various parts of the country, and also the overall international situation, which is very disadvantageous in relationship to any type of U.S. or NATO intervention in Syria, direct intervention in Syria, I believe that this, of course, is being utilized to provide a rationale and a justification for the escalation of military, political, as well as diplomatic pressure against the Syrian government. It's no strange phenomena that this is taking place right in the aftermath of the routing of the rebels in Al-Qusar just over a week ago. And, of course, these developments on the ground inside Syria does not bode well for U.S. interests, which is exclusively designed to bring about the downfall of the government of President Bashar al-Assad. I think we need to really find out what concrete evidence they have that the Syrian government is involved in the utilization of chemical weapons. The Syrian government, it would definitely not be in their interest to utilize chemical weapons in a situation where they, in fact, have the upper hand against these Western-backed rebels.
Okay, let me just come in there, because Carla Del Ponte is a very respected diplomat and chief UN investigator on Syria, and we can listen now to what she has said about chemical weapons use in Syria.
Our investigators have been in Syria and in neighboring countries, interview victims, doctors, and field hospitals. And in the latest report we got last week, I saw that although there is still no incontrovertible proof, there are very strong suspicions, judging by the kind of medical help the victims received, that sarin gas has been used by the opposition, rebels, and not the country's authorities. But it's not surprising, because militants and people from outside have already infiltrated the opposition.
So listening to that, I mean, what evidence does Washington have to the contrary, do you think?
Well, this is very interesting. The fact that this United Nations investigator is claiming that there is evidence that would suggest that the Western-backed opposition forces have been using sarin gas. We don't hear hardly anything in this regard as it relates to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, or the White House. So why all of a sudden now that the Syrian government is being accused of using chemical weapons, when in fact there's evidence that would suggest that other forces in the opposition, which are indirectly being armed, financed, and given political support by the West through their various proxy entities in the region, in the Gulf states, vis-a-vis Turkey, Jordan, and also certain elements in Lebanon, it's quite obvious, and this has been even written about in the Western press, that they are indirectly supporting and arming these counter-revolutionaries in Syria. So they won't take into consideration any human rights violations, any crimes against humanity that are being committed by the opposition forces, but any opportunity, whether it is justified or whether it's a complete fabrication, that they can blame the Syrian government for committing crimes, they immediately move in that direction as a means of justifying further military action. Now, they have wanted for some time to declare that they will openly arm the Syrian opposition, but they are doing it anyway. Now, it would be very problematic for them to declare a no-fly zone over Syria and begin to engage in airstrikes over Damascus and Aleppo and other cities throughout the country, because you have the support of other countries that have said that they will not allow the United States or the UN to carry out bombing operations against Syria. So they've been utilizing the Israeli Air Force. They've been utilizing other proxy forces in order to carry out military actions against Syria. I think this is representative of the dilemma that the U.S. is facing and the European countries that are against Syria. And we just have to follow the situation very closely. I know that most people inside the United States and most people in the international community do not want another war, a full-fledged war that will involve ground troops and even aerial bombardments against the people of Syria. It would, of course, be regional in its implications. The southern Lebanese people, of course, would be involved in this situation. Iran would be directly affected by it, as well as Russia and other countries throughout the region.
Okay, Mr. Azikiwe, thank you very much for coming on to RT tonight to express those views. We have run out of time, but thank you. That's Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire.
And that was an interview done by Abiyomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, over RT just this last past week. And, of course, we were discussing the situation involving the escalating war against the Middle Eastern nation of Syria. And it is, of course, something that is being followed very closely over the Pan-African Newswire. You can, of course, tune in to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And you can do that, and, of course, you can stay abreast with developments in Syria, developments throughout the African world, and, indeed, the international community as a whole. And we'd just like for you to, of course, log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. And on the Pan-African Radio Network, you can hear this program again, forward this program to other potential listeners, and also delve into the archives of the Pan-African Journal. And this is Abiyomi Azikiwe, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Ain't got nobody. around from town to town. She look at home, baby, no mind. Let me tell you what I'm trying to find. A girl who's for real all the time. She don't have to wear a wig, but she don't have to be too big. And it ain't given community. As long as she loves me, I ain't got nobody. I ain't got nobody.
I Ain't Got Nobody, two different versions from Sly and the Family Stone. One slated the original version, which was not as tight and did not include as many instruments as the second version we heard from the album Dance to the Music, Sly and the Family Stone from 1968. And, of course, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And, of course, just this last past week, there has been a plethora of activity related to the situation in the city of Detroit. Of course, yesterday there was a news segment that appeared on the public broadcasting system, and that is shown all across the country. They covered, of course, developments in the city of Detroit, and we wanted to relay a segment of yesterday's PBS NewsHour that covered the current situation in the city of Detroit. They were covering the meeting held by state-imposed emergency manager Kevin Orr that took place at the library. It took place at the airport yesterday in Wayne County Airport, and that, of course, where Orr announced his new plan for the revitalization, ostensibly, of the city of Detroit. And we, of course, were there yesterday to cover activities that were taking place both outside as well as inside of the meeting sponsored by Kevin Orr. And we like to play a segment from the PBS NewsHour of yesterday, in which the question of the responsibility for the Detroit crisis was raised during that interview. And, of course, the city of Detroit is, as we speak, being hit with an economic crisis, with the demand that Detroit owes over $16 billion in debt. And we're going to listen to this segment, which features an interview with Abiyomi Ezekwe.
Detroit and its creditors were presented with a series of painful options. Retired city workers were warned of significant cuts in pensions and health insurance, and creditors were told the city won't be able to pay them back. The day started with an announcement that the city government already defaulted on some debt. It got worse from there. Ray Suarez has the story.
Make the banks pay!
A handful of protesters picketed outside the Westin Hotel this morning, while inside, Detroit's emergency manager, Kevin Orr, laid out a last-ditch plan to 150 creditors to accept pennies on the dollar in order to help keep the city running. Orr told reporters afterwards that Detroit's finances are beyond dire and that his plan to avoid filing bankruptcy is going to be hard, it's going to be difficult, but what choice do we have? during the meeting Orr said the city would stop payments on its unsecured debt to bondholders, cut health care and pension benefits to current and retired city workers, give an independent authority control over the water and sewerage. The changes helped tackle what Orr said was up to $20 billion in debt and liabilities. He was appointed 3 months ago by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder to try to turn around Detroit's finances and operations. But there's been skepticism among some residents about the plans and about whether Detroit's finances are as dire as Orr has said. Abayomi Azikiwe protested the meeting this morning.
We feel that the bankers and the creditors who are here today with the emergency manager are not going to negotiate in the best interest of the people of the city of Detroit. And we're saying that the same financial institutions that Mr. Orr is negotiating with today are responsible in large part for the crisis that exists in Detroit.
Once a booming Midwestern city, Detroit has suffered a big population loss and now ranks as the poorest major city in the U.S. More than a third of the population lives below the government poverty line.
We get more on the plan spelled out today and the reaction to all this from Matt Helms.
And it kind of goes down after that, but that was a segment from yesterday's PBS NewsHour, and of course, so we wanted to play that because it does feature a segment on the Moratorium Now Coalition, which was on hand out at Detroit Metropolitan Airport, Wayne County Metropolitan Airport, yesterday, June 14th, discussing the future of the city of Detroit. And of course, we're going to continue to cover the struggles and developments around emergency management in the city of Detroit. Last week, there was a panel in which yours truly participated in, which was dealing with the various mass struggles that are taking place across the United States. And yours truly, Abayomi Azikiwe, presented a paper at the Left Forum, among three other papers. This paper, of course, dealt with the history of the struggle for a moratorium here in the city of Detroit and in the state of Michigan over the last several years. And, of course, that segment will be available on video in the not-too-distant future, and we'll share that information with you when it does become available. And right now we're going to be winding down the Pan-African Journal for this week. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. In order to share this program with other potential listeners, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, the Blog Talk Radio, Pan-African Radio Network, and you can, of course, access the Pan-African Journal radio broadcast for distribution via blog and website through social networking mechanisms such as Facebook and Twitter. And also other broadcasters are more than welcome to utilize the content in full or in part of the Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Creates bad illusion. Sometimes the wrong one loses.
yearn, baby, and yearn. Or you be sitting around like the underdog one of these days, talking about dern, baby, and dern. So get yourself together and get you together.